We get things rolling by getting on board that G&M Family Market phone line for our weekly conversation with the hardest working man in the literary world. He's our friend, Colin Fleming. Colin, good afternoon.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, very well, thank you. I saw that you enjoyed that Patriots game over the weekend. That was impressive. And, well, my gosh, every time we think we've seen a new way for them to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat, they come up with something new.
It's much more enjoyable after the game, isn't it? When you look back and you think, oh, that was so nice. But while you're watching it, it's like, oh, no, will I make it through? It's horrible.
Well, they found a way to get it done and now take on the Eagles. And I said this yesterday, I have to have great respect for any city that feels the need to cover their telephone poles and light poles with Crisco for the post-victory celebration.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't even know about that. You saw the thing in New York City, right?
With
the Empire State Building. And that put everybody off, and I guess you can't have Boston cream donuts in Philadelphia right now, so the Daftig people must be very upset. But, yeah, I'm sure it'll probably work out a lot like it did 14 years ago, I would imagine.
It seems to be headed that way, definitely. Well, today we wanted to talk with you about one of the classics of literature and the many adaptations in the cinematic world. It's the 200th anniversary this month of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yes, and you know what? When you mentioned the adaptations, the filmic adaptations, and then we have, of course, the original novel, I think it's one of the rare novels where as many people like have read that as they've seen films about it. You don't get that too often. You usually get like one or the other. Even with Gone with the Wind, I think more people now, especially over the decades, know the film. So this is the kind of weird little duality we get with this book that came out 200 years ago.
And a remarkable book for those who haven't read it. And Mary Shelley did not have a long and distinguished career as a writer, but you know, boy, if you do one that's pretty well perfect, you don't need to.
She was so young, too. She was 20 years old when it came out. And I think a lot of people know the genesis of the novel. It's the summer of 1816, and she is holidaying in Switzerland, Lake Geneva, with Lord Byron, probably not like an innocent guy you want to go on a holiday with, and her eventual husband, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and John Polidori, who was Byron's personal doctor, kind of like his Alex Guerrero, I guess you could say. And it was a dark and stormy night, as it were, and someone said, hey, let's write some ghost stories. And Mary Shelley wrote what she wrote. Byron was having a hard time coming up with something, supposedly. Polidori wrote a kind of like dry run for Dracula that Byron later said he wrote, and Shelley didn't do too much. So it was basically future Mary Shelley, who came up with this story that absolutely creeped everyone else out.
And among the many things that have lived on for these 200 years is the mistaken notion that the monster is somehow called Frankenstein and not the doctor.
Right. I have a pet theory about that. I think it's because in October 1957, a package of films called the Shock Theater Package went out to television stations across the country. And this included a lot of the early Universal horror films. Dracula was in there. Frankenstein from 1931 was in there. Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman from 1943 was in there. And I think it was really that film in particular, because it was kind of this mashup of these monsters. We have it so commonly now where I don't really follow them that much, but you have The Flash and Aquaman doing stuff together, right? And they're taking on Ghost Rider, and then they rope Superman into something. Well, this was kind of the first one of those. And no one thought it was Dr. Frankenstein taking on the Wolfman. And I think that's how that became conflated. And then if you grew up, well, in New England, for instance, you might remember the show Creature Double Feature. Come on Saturdays, and it would play these old, often Universal horror films. And that happened in markets all around the country. And I think that's where the baby boomers started getting this notion that Frankenstein was this monster. And it wasn't exactly helpful in that in the novel, Frankenstein is Victor Frankenstein. In 1931, for Universal, Colin Clive, he becomes Henry Frankenstein. And so I think people didn't even know, well, who the hell's Frankenstein? Well, it's this monster. He's so fierce. that's where it stuck.
How do you think that Universal group of films were, and how true were they to the original?
They were true in the sense of, it might be subtle, but it's very potent, this notion of overreaching ambition. They weren't true plot-wise, but in 1931, you have Colin Clive, who always looked older than he was. He died really young, actually. He was only 37 years old when he died, and this is just a few years before that. And he has this famous creation scene with the Kenneth Strickfaden machinery that they rented out, basically, to make a lot of noise, bark. And he says this line, and the censors, of course, whacked it out, because you think, oh, you can't do that, where the monster comes alive, and he says, "Now I know what it feels like to be God." Well, you can't say that, can you? I mean, but that's very much that whole Promethean notion that Mary Shelley herself was drawing on. And one of the other texts she was drawing on was Milton's Paradise Lost. And it's interesting because so often Milton calls God, the God character, who's actually super boring in Paradise Lost, he calls him the victor. And I think that's where Mary Shelley might have gotten that name. Now, in Paradise Lost, by far, the most interesting character is the devil. He's loquacious, like the monster would later be, right? The monster in the novel comes into a scene, and you think he's going to be this, like, grunting character, maybe, if you haven't read the book? This dude is a paragon of loquacity. He walks into the scene, you think, oh, here we go. Here comes 18 minutes of, like, abstruse theory from Milton. He's read every book. He just will not stop.
Now, what about, you say there's an underrated film in the canon that people ought to check out, and that's Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, right?
I would say there are two underrated films, really, because we go from Frankenstein in 1931 to Bride of Frankenstein in 1935. Now, horror films do not get a ton of plaudits critically. A lot of times the stuff that wins the Academy Awards, or wins Grammys for that matter, is not really anything that's going to last. And horror films and comedy have never gotten much respect. Bride of Frankenstein is a film that you can put up there, an American film, with Vertigo, with The Searchers, with Citizen Kane. It can hang with those. And that was also James Whale. But we don't have James Whale for the third picture in the original cycle that stars Boris Karloff as the monster. So from 1939, we have Son of Frankenstein with Basil Rathbone as the titular character. And that's this very Baroque kind of like Rococo film. It's a lot longer than the other two. And people tend not to seek it out because James Whale is gone by then. Then a few years later, we have Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. And it, yeah, can't be fun. Directed by Roy William Neal. He did a lot of the Rathbone Bruce Sherlock Holmes pictures. But the opening scene, for sheer creepiness, matches anything to come out of the Universal Vault. And Bela Lugosi's in it, and it hangs together really well as an action picture married to a kind of gothic horror that also was not dated in the gothic age. You never knew when the time period was for these pictures, and I think that's helped them age really well.
And what do you think of the Hammer Studios film series?
Well, that was a real big sort of restart for the whole notion of gothic horror. And people don't realize now, when they see these films and maybe Turner Classic Movies around Halloween time, they were so galvanizing in their day. The color, they just washed the screen with these kind of sensory-altering colors that were not aligned to a reality. This became the new reality. When you see the blood in a film like that, it doesn't even look like real blood, but it becomes basically the new definition for that hour and a half of blood in your mind. And they were very titillating, too. Not in the way that we find things titillating now, in the way like a cowboy would have in 1853 when he got a glimpse of an ankle. But still, it's along those lines of this shock. And it was very much Peter Cushing, it was Christopher Lee, who seemed to live forever. And there was this edge to Cushing's character as, and he goes back to being Victor Frankenstein, where he was going far beyond the bounds of just pushing the envelope on science. He is pushing the envelope on every kind of morality There is. I don't know how well those films would go over right now with the PC Brigade, but they are their own kind of canonical film works.
We've had a few attempts from people in recent years to pick up on the story with another version of Frankenstein, with I, Frankenstein, but none of them have been particularly successful, and which is interesting to me because I would think with the advances in science that this is a story that if it were done right could really ring true once again in this age.
I agree. I think part of the problem is those attempts have become too sanitized, like the Kenneth Branagh version, where there's this Shakespearean fidelity almost, right, to the text. And when you think about like a Shakespeare picture, which is similar, and you think of how someone like Orson Welles handled those films, he would take a red pen to Shakespeare and he would just turn that page vermilion, basically, like, woof, getting all this out of here. He was not gentle with it. And I think people want to be so faithful to what Mary Shelley was doing that they're not realizing that there is a big disconnect between what might work well on a page and what works well on a screen. And that's something that James Whale, for instance, didn't struggle with. So you have these very sort of sermonizing, moralizing, almost like Bram Stoker's Dracula, where there's this fealty to the original text. It takes all of the fun out of what you might get going on the big screen.
Interested, too, you mentioned as we were communicating about the segment this week that you're working on a book about the 1951, that's the Alistair Sim Scrooge, right?
Right. That'll be out at the end of the year, and it's a picture that I watched throughout the year, and I think a lot about horror films because they were an early touchstone for me in terms of how I thought about narrative and how it could be put together. I remember I was over my grandmother's once and I walked into a room and I was just young and that 1931 version of Dracula was playing on the television. It was that scene where they're in the examining room and they're looking at the needle marks on the neck and I just thought, oh wow, that's really nuts. And so Scrooge was something when I first saw it that I realized, hey, this has a lot to do with Gothic expressionism, with films like The Golem from 1915, which is a huge influence on those early Frankenstein pictures. And yes, it's a Christmas film, but it's also not Christmas film at all. There are elements of film noir and the Gothic and the Eldritch, and the sort of cinematography is straight out of parts of the 1931 Frankenstein. And again, these films ultimately come down to not necessarily what terrorizes us on the outside, but the fear that manifests itself in all of us. And that's really the horror that lingers and has the most impact.
Yeah, to me, that's the best kind right there. Colin, always great talking with you. Thank you, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
All right, sounds good.
Colin Fleming, every Tuesday here on Downtown.